Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is he's a little upset after an incident at the Shogun's castle. His name is Joel. I think it's best that he explains his issues.
My name is Joel. I am a Ronin. My master was punished cruelly because he accidentally ate fries off the wrong plate at the Shogun's house. His rival got no blame whatsoever, even though he obviously left his fries unattended for more than 30 minutes. And I seek this revenge by, I don't know, what's a good revenge for that case? I guess I could send garbage to his house.
Yeah, find out if he's allergic to anything, and like in a Miss Doubtfire.
Man, that's super dangerous. Like, he almost kills that guy. First of all, almost kills that guy in Miss Doubtfire. And then, I don't know if you listen to the Shockwaves podcast, but every once in a while, Rebecca McHenry is like, "So I was in the hospital because I almost died," because she's got like extreme allergies. It's like, oh, please, God, I hope I never have to listen to that podcast and be like, and she just didn't make it this time, guys, because I will give up listening to everything.
Yeah.
So a sad note to start on. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Restarted my character in Fallout 4. Now she's more intelligent, and I can upgrade my weapons. It doesn't matter. Yes.
It's about time.
The laser weapons, so that's why I chose intelligence to focus on.
Of course. So is this actually a pair with anything, or did you just feel like watching
Is just a random... I meant to watch it at some point, so why not now?
Don't get me wrong. I'd already seen this before. The Kenji Mizoguchi 4-hour version of the 47 Ronin 1941, because I used to do this project where I was going through the criterion in alphabetical order, and like, you know, this came up in the numbers section, 47 Ronin. I was like, well, I already dedicated myself, and I was absolutely crazy entranced by it. Like, I thought this was filmmaking at the finest, and I was so glad that I just randomly stumbled upon it. So when you were like, we're going to watch it at the podcast, I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah, your endorsement of it before was real encouragement. I was like, okay, yeah, it probably is worth doing an episode on. Because we kind of need to cover more Mizoguchi.
Yeah. I feel like with its length, it's the same kind of daunting you have with a Kurosawa movie. And it's interesting to me how much, after watching this, like, epic that has very little action. There's basically only one real scene with any action in it. And, like, compared to a Kurosawa, you know, Seven Samurai, or one of his other longer ones, it's like, you can actually see how much Hollywood is reflected in Kurosawa's, like, later work. And then how much Mizoguchi is just setting this all out kind of like a play. You know, with all the dialogue heavy scenes, everything is told through the stories and the actions of the characters, but in such a way that you can, like, I personally could not help but be, like, totally involved in their story and fascinated by the customs of the I don't want to say ancient, the older Japanese customs, and the rankings of the different people. And the costuming.
Oh, yeah.
Man, it's black and white, but I feel like I could see all the color and everything.
Yeah, the only thing I don't like about this is not...
It's full of Japanese people.
Yes, yeah, so I'm Charles Bronson and Kinjite. No, it's...
I know it.
I'm just thinking about that scene where he... Never mind. He tortures a man in a bizarre way in that movie. Don't... Maybe watch Kinjite. Who knows? Anyways.
No, I have to watch Kinjite. I've been told that it's terrible, and I must watch it.
It is terrible, but...
All right.
Yeah, the transfer is not too great, but that's kind of the problem with a lot of the older, specifically Japanese films. Like, a lot of the Kinoshita stuff, early Ozu stuff, there are other people from the era who have stuff out that I can't think of offhand, but like it's always not the best transfer because it kind of was not kept in the best condition.
Right.
Yeah, I mean they were trying to come. That became like a movie producing house. Like who did this one? It's not a not Toho.
It's Mizuguchi. So yeah.
Oh, there we go. Shoji. I mean, those guys were like pumping out movies every month, I feel like. So to get an epic like
Well,
this,
yeah, them and Nikatsu, aka the oldest Japanese studio.
Exactly. Yeah. Nakatsu is like the I don't know. I was gonna say something
MGM?
like
Who was first in America?
MGM,
Fox
but
or MGM? I don't know.
I mean, technically Edison,
Yeah, but
but
he didn't think movies had any
I mean,
commercial.
Fox did not come until after MGM,
So
I'm pretty
yeah,
sure.
Nikatsu.
Fox was collaboration or you know
Yeah.
the studios
Yeah, so
connecting
yeah,
together.
MGM, Nikatsu is like the MGM and Shochiku was, they picked up right afterwards and were like, hey, we can do this too. And Toho formed, I think, in the
Yep.
30s. Toho was kind of late, but they kind of burst on the scene real big, real fast, comparatively.
Yep, they found some directors that they were solid and consistent, and they gave them, they gave them jobs and basically kept pumping out every once in a while, giving them something that they really wanted to do. So it seemed like to me.
Yeah, Trachiku, they were doing stuff with Ozu and Kiyoshida. Wait, no, Kiyoshida was a couple years off. He is still. I'm not sure if you know like what the system was, but it's basically you would start out to like the lowest level as like a crew member person, and you'd kind of have every job on a film set until, like a decade later or whatever, they promote you to director. And so by the time you're a director, you have experience in like literally every single aspect of filmmaking.
Yeah, that's funny that they treat it like a normal job. Like, oh, you start on the lowest rung, and then as you get, you might get promoted, you might not. And I think that kind of works to favor of, especially like you can recognize that on American media, like when somebody obviously has experience as an actor or a cinematographer or even things like music and set design, and then they move on to directing. Sometimes something will just like stand out much stronger than everything else, and there are certain directors where it's just like they've got the full package, and you can tell that they have a lot of experience working in all of the mediums that go together to make this film art.
Like that, tying back to Mizoguchi, like that's part of why he was such a master. He, like before he got on way early on, but like he obviously was familiar with all the aspects of filmmaking. So like that's why he's able to make, something like this, which is like only he could make something like of this quality at this point in time in Japan.
Yeah, I've only seen four Mizoguchi. I've seen and at least, or maybe all of them were for this podcast. I'm trying to see here.
This and Unamaro, and
Yeah, Odomaro and his five women,
that's it.
Princess Yagwe fan. Oh, we haven't done Ugetsu. I guess that's the only one we haven't done for the podcast that I watched.
That could be an episode of
That apparently I liked a lot, and I can't remember
that could be
anything
on
about
your
it.
other podcast because they're supernatural.
Well, sure, I assume everybody's
Yeah,
a ghost. Yeah.
you can have like Randall on or something.
Randall Park?
Yes, no, Randall, your friend, your director buddy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as soon as he's done, he's tinkering on that new movie he's still
I thought he
working on,
started filming
so.
another movie, or he's in pre-production or something.
He's still doing it's the Monsters Without,
Okay.
and he's on
Okay.
post-production
Yeah,
on it.
I don't know. He's busy making movies, Anyway.
Yeah, he's a guy living the
Yeah.
dream. Not that I dream of making movies, but
But
it's better than my job.
same here. But one of Mizoguchi's crew members is Kanato Shindo, who went on to be the first major Japanese independent director, and he worked with Mizoguchi on several of his movies, doing mainly set design, and he did set design for 47 Ronin. And Shindo, he wrote and directed Onibaba, which if you haven't seen that, you really need to. It's a great, great classic horror movie. And he did some, and this other one, Kuroneko, which is another really great like ghost horror movie, and there are cats in that. So if that can go on your list of movies with cats.
Sounds too scary.
Well, he's a really interesting guy. He was basically doing like indie stuff from the mid-50s to the 2000s. And on his deathbed, I think he would be 100 or 99, he was still talking to people like, you gotta get the pre-production ready on this other movie. I have a script written for it. Like, up until the end, he was like, no, I have to still keep working. Yeah, Mizoguchi kind of gave him his career, and this is another tangent, but if you watch his movies, he likes to film stuff in nature a lot. In his mind, like trees and wind and like this stuff in nature could have like characteristics that are interesting to see on camera. Where Mizoguchi, I've seen enough of his movies to also pick up on this. Mizoguchi did not like to film like trees or grass or animals, because in his mind, that's all that stuff is boring. What's interesting is people's faces and people's bodies, and not like, anything non-human on screen.
Sure.
Which I strongly disagree. Like, oh, and it was the Wrong Reel podcast had Tony Stella on. Talking about Japanese ghost films, and Tony Stella is an expert in basically everything film related, and he was talking about Mizoguchi, and Mizoguchi apparently did not like the 47 Ronin. He thought it was not up to his standard, and he always not talked it down, but he was like, yeah, it's I have other movies too. Like, he was not too happy with it.
Let's talk about the things I
Yeah.
like. It's like Buster Keaton with a general, or I guess every people prefer things like Steamboat Junior and or what is it,
I know what
Steamboat?
you're talking about. Disney ripped him off.
Yeah, and no, what? That's an old story.
Disney didn't rip him off?
I mean, he was. It's not based on an
Okay.
original thing that he came up with. But yeah, Sherlock Jr., stuff like that. But his favorite movie was The General that he did. And
And people always liked everything else he did. Right, so
So, any interesting facts about this movie?
besides Mizoguchi thinking it's not his best, not really.
He's wrong. Actually, I don't know what his
My
best is.
favorite of his is Women of the Night, because it's a precursor to basically the Pinky Violence movies of the 70s. And it's kind of sleazy for like a 40s movie, but it's still like, within the appropriate content range of like a 40s movie. But if you look at compared to like Female Prisoner Scorpion or like the Girl Boss series, it's like, oh, this is totally a precursor to all those, to the whole movement of films. But
I've seen The Girl Boss on Netflix.
yeah. And then there's another series
Cool.
called Delinquent Girl Boss, which is a completely different series of films. Yeah, it gets real confusing with that stuff. But I think
Trying
Ugetsu is,
to.
I think, is the best one personally. But that's my opinion.
Yeah.
I think other people would disagree.
Yeah, I mean, I gave Ogetsu 5 out of 5, and I gave this movie 5 out of 5. I think he's just got it's just mastery for those two when it comes to filmmaking. I was looking at the cast, and I actually, at least based on the very few members that are listed on Letterboxd, nobody else seems to be in anything else that I've watched, with the exception of Daisuke Kato, who I definitely recognized in the movie. He's, you know, he's got a chubbier face.
He's a bit younger. Kind of he's not playing an idiot. So it's like, that can't be him.
Yeah. He doesn't have his unibrow. Yeah, but I mean, that's a guy who's been in a bunch of stuff we've seen. He's usually playing some sort of
or a stupid person.
And this time he was just one of the guys from the other city that was like, why aren't we doing anything? I want to do something now.
Kind of refreshing, like, oh, he was young. I'm used to him being middle-aged. But most actors I don't recognize. It's people from, like, the... basically, who didn't work with, like, Ozu or Kurosawa. So I don't recognize... So a lot of them are not familiar to me.
Well, yeah, based on this, once again, going back to Letterboxd, which I prefer over IMDb because it has pictures of almost everything. The main guy on IMDb, he has about 15 titles. On Letterboxd, this is the only title he's listed for, and he is, I mean, he's the main character in this movie, Yoshizaburo Arashi. Now, he's great.
He was Oshi. Mikatsu.
No, wait. I'm sorry. That was Asano. Oh, man. I'm so wrong.
This was adapted into film, I believe, six or seven times. The only ones I want to bring up is there's a Nikatsu version from 1930 starring Okichi Denjaro, who was in The Man Who Tread on Tiger's Tail as the main... But he's a big guy who was posing as, like, the Buddhist priest.
They were all posing as Buddhist priests. He was the main one
who was trying to convince them.
He was the one that had to recite all the...
He was in the lead role as Oshi in an Inkatsu one. There's the 1941 Minoguchi one, and there is one from 1962 by Toho, by Inagaki, who did a lot of stuff with Toshiro, and according to Wikipedia, which is probably wrong, it's apparently Setsugahara's final film. It's 62, so that checks out. But, I think it's only, like, three hours. Mm. You know, only 3 hours compared to 4 hours. But,
yeah, it's nothing.
I'd be curious to compare the various versions. And there's the Keanu Reeves version that,
I mean, that's got to be a name only, right?
I guess. I didn't even look into it at all.
I just remember the trailer, and, like, there's, like, you know, dragon lady tattoo thing, and there's monsters and stuff like that. There's one of the Japanese, I assume he's Japanese actors, is like, we cannot take this on ourselves. We are only 47. And I was like, oh, man, that's, unless you're referencing the story, why would you pick that random number?
Yeah.
It's just, it's dumb. Dumb city.
Only, not terrible thing about that, besides Keanu, is there's an actor, Hiroyuki Sanada is in it. He's in some kind of mainstreamy stuff, but I've seen in my Sonny Chiba series of reviews, he showed up, I think, 3 of the 4, and he's a really good actor. And that's all I have to say about him. He's just I like seeing him on screen. I won't watch him in 47 Ronin, but it's a good later. He got to be star next to Keanu, which not many people get to.
What the hell? Okay, so I'm looking at Wikipedia and looking at the actual article about 47 Ronin, the actual story and its adaptations. It says, most recently it was made into a 2013 movie titled 47 Ronin. That's the one we're talking about, Keanu Reeves, a bunch of other weirdos. Released in December 25th, 2013. And then again into a more stylized version, Last Nights, released April 3rd, 2015. This version has Clive Owen and Morgan freaking Freeman in it. I don't even know. It's a co-production between U.S., South Korea, and the Czech Republic.
Clive Owen?
Clyde Warren. I mean, Clive Owen, what yes.
What year? 2015?
2015. Directed by Kazuaki Kiriya. Oh, and an adaptation of Goemon? I gotta see this. Okay, maybe it's a great movie. I don't know. I just... So the 47 Ronin is laid out extremely play-like.
Kind of like Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering if it was like, these are the people who played all 47 of the Ronin, because that scroll goes on for a long time. And in this case, as opposed to Star Wars, which is scrolling up the screen, you know, the graphic style is scrolling text. This looks to be a literal scroll.
It's a literal scroll. Well, yeah, it felt like the Star Wars crawl was a literal scroll, but yeah, I know what you mean.
What? Well,
like, the effect of it's like it's a papers on rollers with stuff written on it.
And in space?
It's made to look like space.
I thought they just animated
it. Shows what I know. Like, behind-the-scenes photos of, like, them filming the scroll and, like, people are turning the wheel, or, like, turning like a crank or whatever, so it keeps rolling.
Well, this is news to me.
I get they did some digital, like, effects and stuff. Not digital effects.
Get George on the phone.
I don't want to talk to George.
Son of a bitch. He's probably seen this.
And the setup of, like, the whole, a small group of people trying to fight a bigger, you know, empire.
Yes. But
this still feels vaguely like, I feel like Lucas got some inspiration for Star Wars from this.
Absolutely.
Some actors feel like, Lucas really likes Japanese movies.
I mean, he's the original Quentin Tarantino. He just took a bunch of things that he really liked and put them in there. Or Martin Scorsese is the original Quentin Tarantino. Or Steven Spielberg. You know what? Everybody does it. Everybody needs to get over themselves.
I'm not saying it's bad that George does this. Kind of like, he, like Tarantino, is very, very glaring about it. And sometimes, like, can you change it a little bit, maybe?
Yeah, that's
true. There's some Tarantino...
Some
Tarantino stuff, like Kill Bill, it's just like, can you just not use Meiko Kaji songs in this original score or something? Just don't repurpose songs that mean a lot to me. But that's my opinion.
You know, because of that, we got more of the 5, 6, 7 nights.
More of that. I don't need them to repurpose, you know, like music from Thinking of Violence movies.
I mean, nobody's using it.
Yeah, I understand. For me, it bothers me, but for someone who doesn't know that, it's just like a cool song. So I'm the asshole in this scenario. I'm aware.
I mean, you're not. You have a loyalty to it. I understand that. Like, I feel like the part of the appeal of Quentin Tarantino movies is kind of this gateway where it's like, you find out he's taken all this stuff, and maybe that's your way to, like, start seeing these, like, unique movies that he was actually taking it for. You know, when else are you going to watch Quadrophenia or any of those Japanese movies?
Yeah, it's true.
Blaxploitation stuff.
Yeah, like, I used to be like, who cares? But now I like Pinky Violence movie, and it's like, oh, I understand what people have been complaining about for years now. Like, I understand their irritation.
I mean, I'm 100% honest, that's the way I felt in the beginning of Django Unchained when they just straight up played the Django theme song.
Yeah.
It's like, seriously, you're not going to do anything with it?
Okay. If you've seen Mandingo or early weird slavery dramas from the 70s, it's like, oh, you're just trying to make a slavery drama, but more palatable. Where Mandingo is a strange movie. It's worth watching. Don't watch Drum. It's a fucking waste of time. Drum is a sequel that is complete garbage. There's a reason no one talks about Drum.
So the year is
Yes.
1701. Feudal Japan, I guess. I mean, it's not really. I mean, you think about it in context of what was happening in the United States. You know, the pilgrims were
It's the
already over here.
Tokugawa regime in Japan. They're. Were they? I'm not sure if they were emperors or just a shogun, because the emperor for a point, for a stretch of time, emperor just kind of was a figurehead that didn't mean anything. The shoguns had all the real power. So I think the Tokugawa were their shogun family. But
Well, everyone treats him like he's the big
they
boss.
talk about the emperor, but it's kind of like, it's like the Queen of England. It's like, oh, we have the Queen's approval, but you kind of don't. It's just kind of, you know, it's ceremonial.
In the Genroku period, it says Genroku a
I
bunch of
thought that
times
was
in the scrolls.
Tokugawa.
I'm not sure what that means. Anyways, the way this movie starts off is we are at a beautiful, almost palace-like location. It turns out it's one of the shogunate's location, and there is a meeting that is supposed to be happening. And the first thing that happens is there's an older man who we find out is Lord Kira. And he is chastising one of the servants at the palace, saying the decorum of what's going on here was completely ignored. You can't have an amateur lord like Lord Asano just come up and just destroy protocol. I'm not going to meet with him. There's nothing that's going to happen today, so I'm just going to leave. So he starts to walk away. Lord Asano is. This happens a bunch of times in the movie. People are within earshot distance, and like the person who's talking knows that's happening, and he doesn't care if they're insulted. They don't care if they know that they're mad at them or that they wish they were gone. It's that kind of, you know, not politeness. I don't know what that means. It's like
Well, this is based off the Kabuki play.
it's like passive aggressiveness, you know.
Wait.
Well, Lord Asano takes this moment to stand up from the place he was waiting for Lord Kira, run over to him, take out his blade, and begin trying to kill Lord Kira. He gets one good slice in before he's separated by the guards at the site. Lord Kira is, of course, rushed off. And from here, all the trouble starts. Lord Kira's—he's not fatally wounded. He just gets he gets a
Yeah,
bad cut
and
on
he's
him.
all, it's like a
That
couple inches short of being fatal.
And that's only because Lord Asano had not originally intended to kill him. Although there was an old slight he keeps referring to that he knew that he wanted Kira dead. He acted impulsively, and he, at the time when they capture him, he knows he's going to be punished with death, and he isn't in full acceptance of it. It's completely against the law to take out any blade in the shogunate's palace area, I guess is the case. So Lord Asano's retainers are there, including who becomes our main character, Oshi. And he is, you know, after judgment is handed down, because Lord Kira was attacked, and supposedly Lord Kira, out of, you know, respect for the rules, didn't grab his blade. No fault is placed on him, and Lord Asano is sentenced to have to commit. They keep calling it Harakiri. I prefer seppuku, just because it's easier to say.
The ritual suicide. Where
Right.
this is important, but like they mentioned, like during it you use your short sword and you wear a cotton kimono, a white cotton kimono.
There's a whole ceremony for it. It's just part
Yeah,
of culture
and
there.
the way it's shot initially is the punishment is it's at a high angle, and it's away high angle, like far away, kind of far away from the where the punishment is happening. And then at the end, it's the same thing, but you are actually within the walls, which is a great way of showing, like, you don't get to know Lord Asano. You only hear about Lord Asano, and when his death is very impersonal. But when you get to the deaths of the people you actually do get to know, you're actually physically, like, in the confines of their execution. Which I'm
Correct.
not sure if you noticed that difference in, like, the way it was shot.
And you watch them march,
Yeah.
basically, when their names are called. His ceremony, yeah, it's from above and outside. And we see Oshii, who is saying that Lord Kira is not receiving any sort of chastisement for his. What he did, which was, he did insult Asano
Yeah.
right there, saying that he wouldn't meet with him, even though that was the entire purpose of coming out this place, I guess. And they indicate that it might be because Lord Kira has relatives that are partially responsible for the decision being made. But they decide to let it go, they don't press it farther once everything is decided. We see Lord Asano's wife, who does not know
Is
that this has
that
happened, saying,
Kyo? It's
I'm
the
not
one with the
sure.
long hair that gets cut. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yes. And she's getting, she wants the house prepared for the Lord to get returned, and then the news comes
Yeah.
back. He attacked him and is being sentenced to death. And eventually. Like you said, Lord Asano commits ritual suicide, and his wife is there's another ceremony going on at their house where she has to cut off the long braid of
Yeah.
hair she has, and it's sad. He is at this point, a bunch of things start to go on. A bunch of property is seized from Lord Asano. They don't know whether or not his brother is going to be put into his place, and some people are saying, well, maybe we should get him to do that. But a lot of his retainers, these samurai who all work
Yeah,
under
these
Lord
47
Asano,
Ronin, you could say.
well, at first there were 50 something, and then I think that eventually they just kind of dropped off or left off, went
Yeah,
off
well,
to their
now
own
they're
lives.
47 Ronin because they have no master. And,
They
my,
want
yeah.
revenge.
I just remember,
But Oshii
I
is.
just remembered something that I really like about this movie. It shows that the samurai were just warriors. Like, you get, they actually illustrate that samurai were basically like statesmen slash warriors. And, like, there's, and you kind of get a sense that some of them, I can't remember specifically who, but some of them, like you can tell have never, like, seen combat or anything. They just have been doing, like, their, like, federal job, basically. And it's a lot of, like, procedure and, like bureaucracy. And I like showing that the samurai were more than just, like warriors. It's like, oh no, they was more complex than that. They were a different class, and it's a different they were, statesmen. They had positions in political in the political arena too.
Right, they're up there. One thing about this movie is that we don't touch on the lower
Oh
class
no.
at all. Like, there aren't, the lives of peasants involved or anything like that, with the exception of when the land is being confiscated and a certain amount of, money is being given back to the shogun for payment for grievances or whatever. When they're doing an accounting of the books. That the samurai don't normally do it. It's an interesting scene. Oshii is walking through the room, and all these samurai are sliding on the abacus and writing on his scrolls and counting things and stuff like that. It's because one of the first things they wanted to do was to get an account of how much they had, how much possessions was owed to certain people, and, you know, who to pay off and stuff like that. And there was an argument between a couple of the samurai that's, you know, obviously we need to pay money to the farmers and the people who live under the lord's, you know, on the lord's land, and make sure that they're taken care of. And the other guy's like, no, we need to make sure we pay our debtors, you know, pay the bankers and whatever else that we owe money to, the rich people. And that's only just lightly touched on because, it's showing all the complications of these things that happen when a house is about to be dissolved. You know? And I found that super fascinating because I don't know anything about it.
It's just a different take on the, you know, samurai tale. And this was obviously, not sure if we brought it up earlier, but this is based off a true event that did happen. And it's in the play, like the event turned into a play. It's kind of like, I was trying to think of a good example, not their Macbeth necessarily, but more like their Richard III. Like, it's kind of like a huge deal in Japan. Like, this is considered like an important, you know, work of fiction over there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what I would compare it to. I mean, it feels like
something... Richard III, because Richard III was an actual person.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Shakespeare's historical accuracies when it comes to that. Not to mention, I didn't learn anything other than what we were taught in school, which was, you know, Romeo, Juliet, Macbeth, and Hamlet. Macbeth
is... He has made shit up about... I think it was Denmark. Yeah, like, all the stuff about Denmark is just kind of... He's like,
Hamlet. Well, that's Hamlet. Macbeth is a Scottish play.
Hamlet is, like, a whole lot of him, like, I don't know what it's like over there, so it's, none of it is accurate. It's just an entertaining play. And Richard III was, a politically driven thing, like, to appease the, I think it was the queen, and her personal opinion on Richard III, and her family's opinion.
Played by Judi Dench. Yes.
So the Richard III play is not actually accurate either. It's an entertaining play.
But it is an adaptation of a historical event in some sense. Turned
political.
Just like the movie Young Guns, which you can hear an episode on, and Please Don't Send Me Outer Space, while we do our summer episodes, which are non-science fiction and fantasy movies that we watched when we were kids.
Oh, and on that note, Forrest on Ronin, certain aspects of it remind me of current events with police shootings a little bit.
And I don't know what you're talking about.
I feel like the only reason that really struck a chord with me is I just finished reading The Hate U Give, which is which the movie comes out in October of this year. But the book is about a black girl who is with her friend, who is a black male, and he is shot by police after he gets pulled over because he's reaching for his hairbrush and then he's killed. And it's just about her experience of being the survivor. And she lives in the quote unquote ghetto, but goes to like the private rich kid school. And so it's about dealing with the two worlds and how they react to, you know, stuff like that. And that really made me like, oh wow, this can be an analogy for like police shootings to an extent.
Yeah. I feel like it doesn't, like, you know, like I said, I don't feel like it touches on anything that the people would necessarily glom onto. I realize it is a historical event, but I feel like it's a very one-sided version of this historical event where it's like, obviously these 47 Ronin were noble. You know, who knows what side it is. That other story sounds like, that's reality.
I took some of this as like some of the stuff like what the emperor thinks and what other lords think is hearsay, and you never know the exact context of how they said it, and stuff like
right
where it could be taken as they were being sarcastic or joking when they said something that sounds like it could be supporting Laura Sano. It's just kind of like, do people think they're right? And you never get a clear sense of whether or not it, like, of the other, what the other lords really think of what the, what their plan is.
Where yeah, it basically. Could, with the exception of yeah. one of the shogunates.
But besides him, like,
who becomes a character. But other, yeah, exactly. All you're hearing is somebody being like, I heard this and person. And just
worded
that.
In such a vague way of like, it sounds supportive, but you didn't hear them actually say it. So you, so it could be taken like, oh, they were condemning them actually. So it's very yeah. specific as to who is right. Where I took it as, well, I'm still trying to figure out if I think it was honorable or not. Because it's still very, you don't get the full details either.
I feel like the men were honorable. I'm not sure if the action was honorable. But based on what we is presented here, it is presented as an honorable act. There's a scene where, speaking of the hearsay thing, there is a scene where a messenger who, you know, has heard that people are actually on Lord Asano's side. And they're really saying, like, oh, everyone heard that Lord Kira was almost cut down. And it was said that even the Emperor himself, when hearing the news, said, it's a pity that he did not complete the task. You know, and people are in tears about this because it's like, oh my gosh, he knows what we mean. Lord Kira needs to yeah. die. But once the land starts getting taken away after some decisions are made, Oshii, at first, like I said, he's playing it coy. He's pretending he doesn't have anything. And then he gets the Ronin who are left together. They're still samurai at this point. They have not been mm-hmm. dissolved yet. And he explains to them that we are going to do this, but we're going to bide our time. We're going to let this, we're going to let Lord Kira feel safe as much as he can be. We're going to agree and let the lands get divided. We're going to let everything happen and we will become Ronin ourselves. And when the time is right, we will go in and take revenge. Like, we could just go and get it right now, but that would not please Lord Asano. Yeah. So they intend to bide their time, and there are people who don't like this idea. They don't want to go along with it, but they do after hearing his... He gives a couple of impassioned speeches, and they all make a blood pact on a like a document they have. And they go about their ways. One of the things that happens is that Oshii makes a mistake. And it's a pretty big mistake that could have, like, ruined all of these plans that they'd made. And when people find out he was the one who was responsible, a lot of people want to just throw him to the side and just go kill Lord Kira. And the mistake he makes is that he pretends by... Or he doesn't pretend. He sends a message saying that, like, we'd like Lord Asano's brother to take his place as the lord of these lands, if that's a possibility. And what he wasn't expecting was so much sympathy to yeah. be on his side. Which is funny, because obviously a lot of people have already expressed, like, I wish Lord Kira was dead and all this stuff like that. And one day a messenger shows up and says, the shogunate himself is going to take this message to the shogun and plead the case. And that's probably going to give Lord Asano back his house, give it to his brother. And that'll fix all the problems, you know, that'll fix the wrong. And because of this, Oshii becomes a drunk who he's got a wife and child, or two children actually. He spends all his time at the local whorehouse.
Getting drunk and, you know, just living a debaucherous life.
Being miserable. He's given up any responsibility. He's not responding to people asking him questions, you know, through letters or messengers or anything like that. Eventually, people have to come from the whatever the other area is that I can't remember. And they demand to talk to him. And so his son takes them over to where he is, which, like I said, is the whorehouse. And they see him. He's being a drunken fool, walking with a bunch of the prostitutes into an area, and he sees these people, and he's like, come on, it's time to celebrate, come over here. And they're disgusted with him, so they leave. His son stays behind. And Oshii explains to him that, his life is misery right now. Like, if he actually succeeds in getting the brother instated as the new Lord Asano, he is not going to be able to live with himself. And that's what he thinks is going to happen. Because so many people were counting on him, counting on his plan, and he feels like he would be letting down Lord Asano without getting revenge.
This is still part one, but is this...
Yep.
Is Asano's wife talk to him yet, or is that on part two?
What is she doesn't talking
approve
about?
Of what they're going to do.
I actually don't remember that part.
Like, there's a whole conflict of she knows what they're going to do, because it kind of becomes public knowledge to an extent, and she does not want them to go on a revenge killing. She thinks it would be dishonorable, especially in her dead husband's name. And there's some...
You meant Lord Asano's...
Lord Asano's widow is not on board with the whole revenge thing. She does not want that to happen. I think that might be in the second part.
If it's the part I'm thinking of, it is the second part. At the end of the first part, Oshii has returned back to his home. And a messenger shows up and says that Lord Asano's brother has been imprisoned and that his land has been confiscated. And this is great news for Oshii because, obviously, that other alternate plan did not work. So, it's time to get rolling on the real plan.
And, a little before this, his old friend shows up because he's like, oh, hey, I heard you got screwed over. Let's go get revenge. And he tells his friend, like, I think it's, I can't remember the exact reason, but he tells her, like, we're not going to do that. Cause I think he's still trying to, be secretive about it. And he brought his son with him.
He tells the old friend, like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to have a disrespected samurai like you join our group. Even if we were going to do something like that, it would be disrespectful to the Asano clan to have someone who used to be one of us back with us again. Oh, even though he's, like, very happy to see him, he's just not willing to bend on it.
And his son is very eager to, you know, be a samurai. And then he is Oshii just, you know, berates the son a little bit, and then they stick around, and I remember it's nighttime, and like the other Ronin are leaving the castle, and
after he's revealed that, like, okay, we can go through with the plan now, he goes outside.
And, his friend and his friend's 14-year-old son have killed themselves because they took the Ronin leaving as a sign of, oh, they're not going to get revenge. And it's like, fuck, man, that I did not expect that to happen.
Yep, and Oshii's basically like, you idiot.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's, like, Oshii's decisions are so held so close to, you know, to the hand or whatever that term is, that saying is. there's a lot of things that can be misinterpreted and do get misinterpreted by his actions. And that's kind of the way part two begins, is because somebody thinks this isn't going to happen anymore. Yeah. It's a man named Daisuke. Is it Daisuke or what is his name?
I wrote down somewhere. I'm looking for it. Because his wife shows up later. Jeruza.
Jeruza's wife shows up later?
Towards the end. Because I think she shows up before. Okay, yeah. She shows up before his name gets called, when he has to kill himself.
You're talking about the woman who pretended to be a samurai? No, this is a different guy.
That's a different guy.
Yeah. This guy's name is something with an apostrophe in it. And I'm looking for it right now.
Oh, wait, so Jeruza was someone else?
Yeah. This guy's name starts with a D.
Oh, wait, yeah, I remember who you're talking about now. I didn't write that.
And I guess it's not important, but he is at a shogunate. Is it a shogunate? Whatever. he's at the palace visiting with his sister. His sister works for the shogunate.
And a play is happening.
Right. They're getting plans for that, and everything's very suspicious, because everyone knows that this guy who's visiting was one of the retainers of Lord Asano. And Lord Kira happens to be coming to attend this play, this no, that's going to happen. So, basically, the shogunate...
Oh, I have his name.
Shogunate?
Shogunate, I think.
Nate.
Whatever. Oh,
shogunates.
The guy's name is Sakaima. Iman? Iman?
I see Kuroyamon.
His name starts with S. Kairo, he's not very tactful, because it's very clear his purpose there.
Yeah, he's pretending like he doesn't have it, and the shogunate is like, come closer, I want to talk to you. I have an official meeting, and basically he's boldly saying, like, I don't want you to know what I'm doing here. I'm just hanging out with my sister, leave me alone.
He's sitting there, and then the shogunate's like, bring him to my quarters. And then he's very defensive, and I believe the shogunate talks about Chinese teachings, and then he talks about he's like, well, we're not Chinese, we're Japanese, we do things differently here. And it's like, okay, his intentions are pretty clear.
The shogunate, being the man who's obviously in a higher position and is gets more respect from everybody, is being incredibly nice to this guy. He knows who came with a sinister intent. And he's like, I'm sympathetic to your cause. I'm absolutely sympathetic to your idea. But it cannot happen. Cannot happen in this house. And from what I understand, there may be another plan going on. And he keeps trying to press him on that, and he won't admit to anything. It's like, well, I think that you need to wait. This other plan that I've heard of sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and it's kind of confusing. Like, he's trying to, to trick him into saying it, because at one point he's telling him, like, Lord Kira, he's old enough. He will die. He'll either die very soon, or he's going to escape, and you won't be able to do it. But then he goes on, then he says, like, almost immediately after that, although it would be proper if you guys did avenge your lord's death. So it's little trickery, and...
Well, he basically gives him, like, a timeline. Like, you didn't realize that, and maybe you guys didn't realize this, but you do actually have a certain amount of time left to get this completed if you are going to do it. And, this also happens to be the shogunate who got the information that he was supposed to give to the shogun about the Lord Asano's brother and possibly raising his position. And he is torn whether or not to do it, because he knows that if he does it, that will stop the revenge plan altogether. And although he feels that he has a duty in his position to deliver this message to the Shogun, he also does not like Lord Kira at all. Yeah. Nobody likes Lord Kira. That's it. Everybody hates Lord Kira. The new TV series starring that bald guy.
Yes. I had nothing.
Well, our Ronin friend eventually he gets upset. He actually sees Lord Kira, and this is a funny part because he's like, his sister is holding him back, even though he's like, I gotta go over there and kill him. I gotta do it right now. It's like, dude, these are paper walls. People can hear you.
Yeah, he's being very loud, and surprisingly, no one is stepping in.
Nope. His sister's like, all right, finally. At first she was trying to convince him not to do it. Now she says, all right, we'll do it tonight. The Noah play is going to be taking place, and he's going to be playing the Demon Lord, whatever. Do you know what that guy's name is?
I'm sure the Noah play that's happening has a connection to the story in some way, probably, because it's Mizuguchi, yeah. But I don't know enough about Noah plays to tell you what that is and what the significance of, you know, of it is exactly. But
it's a play within a play.
And it's based off of a play.
Some meta stuff.
I really like the whole thing of like, oh, you're acknowledging it's based off of a play here. That's real interesting.
Yeah. Anyways, he says that Lord Kira loves the play and he is going to play the part of this Demon Lord in it. And I will attract him to this area and you can cut him down when that happens. So, in the one action scene that's actually in the movie, we see a little garden area in between. We do actually see part of the Noah play happening, you know, the musicians and people doing the poses that go along with the beat and stuff like that. It's like absolutely gorgeous. Like I'm not even talking about this, but all the shots, all the panning of the camera, the sets that they've designed, it's gorgeous.
A lot of, up close and personal, like it feels like we're physically there. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Who was that guy? Max. It's like, I think he's a German director who is known for like a lot of camera movement. What's the guy's name? He did the Earrings of Madame something. Yes.
Ophuls.
Yes. It's kind of like, I haven't seen his movies, but that's why I hear how people talk about his camera work, where it's like it's immersive and moving, and like physically moving. Yeah. And apparently, Ophuls is a big influence on Kubrick.
Yeah, it is. I'm thinking of one specific scene where one of the characters is going and opening the windows in the house, and the camera is just panning along as he's doing this thing, and it's, you know, it feels very neorealism, honestly. And that shot, but everything that, at least of the couple that I've seen of Oval's stuff, is these grand productions, you know, like almost Hollywood style colors and stuff like that. But I mean, you can see why film lovers love his stuff.
Mizuguchi is in the same camp of like using.
Absolutely, camp. I mean, this movie. We're talking about the story because the story is fascinating and everything that happens and stuff like that. But the film is done so well. There was I was laughing about one costuming part, which is I guarantee is historically accurate. In the very beginning, when Lord Kira is walking away and stuff like that, for some reason the Lord's robes have incredibly long legs that go behind.
Yeah, I noticed that too. They have to pick up their legs.
Like, I just can't imagine either they don't do a lot of walking around on these things, or they have to be replaced pretty often, because if they're anything like jeans, the bottom of it's going to wear out.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, it's formal, where it's like, the people wear that don't have to, you know, interact with the outside world.
I see. Normally he's in Bermuda shorts and tank top.
Yeah.
No. So we're in this garden. We see people heading out towards the play, actors and such like that. And it's quiet. Our Ronan is hiding in the bushes and his sister is standing by. And she sees the man dressed as the demon lord start to walk across. And she gets his attention. He walks over. And the Ronan comes out of the bushes with his sword drawn. Actually, he doesn't have a sword. He has a spear.
Yeah, it's a spear.
And the demon lord begins... You can already tell this is not Lord Kira. Because if it was Lord Kira, he would have been screaming and crying. Instead, whoever is in this costume starts dodging and moving in between a post and him so he can't get hit. The Ronan's making a lot of noise. Once again, nobody's noticing this guy yelling his head off. And eventually, the demon lord gets a hold of him in a way where he cannot attack anymore, takes off his mask, and it is the Shogunate.
Yeah, and he's like, just stop what you're doing.
Like, you were going to attack me. You were going to kill me. And the Ronan at this point, it seems like he's lost his mind because he's like, I can't let you know what was going to happen. I can't let you get away with it, you know, finding out what I was going to do. And so he's like intent on killing this guy, even though he's not the person he wanted to kill in the first place. But eventually the Shogunate like does this job, this amazing job of talking him down. You know, once again, explaining, you need to bide your time on this. I understand your frustration. I understand how angry you are, how much you need revenge for your lord's soul. But this is not the time.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's just like you're just ruining it for everyone else right now.
Yep, just think about how disappointed those other 46 Ronin are going to be. Oh man, he did it without us. And eventually the Shogunate hears the music change and he says, that's the cue for the Demon Lord. And he just puts on his mask again and like backs off and then and runs over and starts performing.
Yeah, we get to see a little bit of it.
Yeah, it's really, that whole scene is really good. And we pan across the groups that are sitting and watching. And we see Lord Kira in his box, surrounded by his guards, and he's just smiling. He has no idea that anything had happened. He said he didn't take the part because he had some sort of injury or something like that, I think he said.
Yeah, and I like the lighting, because like you see the equivalent of like stage lights, which is like candles posted around certain places, and just like the attention to the like design and he in the set here is just like I want my scene to no play in this environment.
Yeah. Well, there's that part even where they're going around lighting the lanterns and you see them like lift up the huge paper with the house symbol on it, you know, and they light the thing underneath, put it back down. And I was thinking like, I could make that. That's amazing. I'd probably burn down my place, but I could probably make it. And this was basically a kind of intermediate story that the Shogunate decided at this point that he was not going to request that Lord Asano's brother take his place.
Yeah.
And we pick up once again at the end, where the end of part one was
it's
basically.
It's the same footage. And Ochi, he's in Edo visiting I'm not sure if he lives in Edo or not, but he's in Edo.
No, he doesn't. That's the place I was trying to think of that the other samurai came from.
But I thought like they showed a scroll on screen and it was like how many months, like 6 months later or whatever, and like he's in Edo for some reason.
He's visiting Lord Asano's widow, right? Yes. So he, I don't think he lives there. He's journeyed up there for one specific reason.
Yes.
And he stops by to visit the widow of Lord Asano. And there is a person in charge of the house there. This is the whatever her family's name was. Toda. I can't remember.
No, Toda.
The Toda family. Yeah, there we go. They live in Edo. That's where their lordship is. And they basically have, you know, she's been living there since the land was seized. And they don't want anything that has to do with any of the Ronin touching that area. It's like undignified for them, like for the family, as far as they're concerned. So when Ushi goes and requests a visit, there's a servant, you know, I assume the head servant of the household, who is just like, this is completely inappropriate. You must tell this man to leave. There's absolutely no way that he's going to be able to see our lady. And that's that. And of course, this is what I was talking about. People talking while the person isn't right in the room next to them. And they obviously hear the displeasure and stuff like that. But somebody, one of the lady's chambermaids knows that she would be anxious to see Oshi. So she goes and fetches her. And much to the head servant's, you know, chagrin, she goes inside there and they have a nice conversation, you know, where they basically just catch up. It's like they're old friends.
Yeah. And she is aware of the plan, and she, I wrote down somewhere, she doesn't want revenge. She doesn't think it'd be honorable to do, you know, to avenge her husband's death. But she does tell him, she won't stand in his way, but she doesn't approve of his intentions.
And before she leaves the room, he requests to go and pray at Lord Asano's grave. And she refuses him, saying that Lord Asano would not like that. And so she leaves, but her handmaiden stays behind. And Oshi hands her a scroll and says, this is just some minor poetry that I've been writing, and I thought that Lady Asano would like to read it, if I could just leave it with you. And she takes it. And from there, we don't really see what happens. We flash forward to later in the evening, and Lady Asano is getting ready for bed. And her handmaiden mentions that Oshi had handed her this scroll. And she's like, well, give it to me. What are you doing? You're ridiculous. And they, you know, it's not, is it poetry or is it? It's not, right?
No, it's the account book for his retainers, right. I think.
It is every... basically, the accounting of everything and money-wise that the Ronin and the people working with the Ronin had spent in pursuit of this revenge plot. And it's just to show, like, how accurate they were keeping everything, so that everything was on the book and there was nothing illegal going on. It's just this, like, honorable thing that he was doing, that somebody could have just written off as like, we're going to die anyways. Yeah. And she's touched by his respect. And I don't know, is it the same night that they get the news that this is going down?
Time is very unclear in this. And
yeah. I mean, the span of this movie is like a year and a half at least,
like,
right?
That. And a messenger stops by with a scroll. And then they read the scroll, and the scroll is the account of the assault on Kira's castle.
Yep. 47 of Lord Asano's former retainers, Ronin, assaulted in the castle of Lord Kira. They killed all guards and members of the house. After 3 searches, Lord Kira was not located at the palace or whatever, at the castle. And at first they're like, oh my god, did they not get him? I mean, did he actually get away? No, continue reading.
And he was hiding behind...
After one last walkthrough, yeah.
He was hiding behind a wall. And Daisuke Kato's character stabs a wall with his spear and kills him.
Yeah. And at first they weren't sure if it was him, but they confirmed it was him by looking at the scar that their master had made on his
Yeah, and they
back.
cut off his head and cut to the Four-Sun Ronin with a severed head walking to.
Yep, at some shrine for
Yes,
Lord
I believe
Asano.
that was his grave.
Yep. So I gotta ask you this. Did you feel disappointed that we didn't actually get to see
No.
that? Me neither. Doesn't that seem weird?
Yeah, a little bit, but.
I mean, like I was like so excited when they were reading the letter, I didn't care. And I feel like it would have taken away from it if they had like while they were reading, they like flashed over to the samurai assaulting this place or anything like that. 'Cause it
No,
wasn't that kind of movie.
it's a, you know, it's a not dry political drama, but like it's
It's an action
it's a like, you know,
play.
it's an, I guess, intellectual. I don't know, that feels that's,
It's a historical drama, in play form, but put to film.
it's, you know, it's not an action movie. It's not like a Kurosawa judo movie. It's, you know,
Right.
it's for everyone, and like you, it's a story you do in a respectful way.
Right. And when you think about it, the two times that we saw violent acts in this movie, they were both considered like to be this huge faux pas, this huge like violation of the respect that was supposed to be shown at each site,
Yeah.
So this, I'm sure, there were dirty things that went down. There were people killed, obviously. They killed way more than Lord Kira in this case. But yeah, I just found like the reading of that letter to be so thrilling that it wasn't until after the movie was over the first time that I was like, there wasn't that big action scene or anything like that, and it didn't need it. It's kind of
And my
crazy.
first thought was, oh wait, they can't do that in 1941. But then I remembered that there were samurai action movies since the 1920s, so they could have easily
Yeah.
done that. Like it was Mizoguchi being like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of the year that it came out, I forgot to mention that at the beginning of each of the parts of the movies, it says support those members of the Japanese army that are off fighting or whatever. It's kind of funny.
Is this
Because
technically propaganda?
this I mean, it is in the sense that it's a historical story that is positive, but I don't it like it doesn't have any direct propaganda other than that message
Yeah,
at the
because
very
like I was
beginning.
trying to think if Mizoguchi made propaganda films, and I'm not. He probably did, but I'm not positive. I know Ozu didn't. Wait, well, he did for the army. And then he was a POW in the Philippines, and then he was released by the Americans. But anyway, that's a story for another time. Ozu's World War II career.
And that's the rest of the story. I'm sure he's got some here. Here's one called Victory Song from 1945. It looks like it's got a
Okay,
military
so if
guy.
he wasn't drafted, he was still making propaganda for studios, and I guess.
Oh, wow. It says it's, according to this one review, Shochiku Wartime Morality Booster, co-directed by everyone available on the studio, including Mizoguchi and Shimizu.
Who was it? Ichiro Honda, he was drafted, and I think he actually served combat. He didn't serve in the propaganda department.
And that's where he saw a giant moth.
Yeah, he hated his time in war, and that influenced his films like Gojira. And, you know, his big monster movie stuff, like apparently his.
Oh yes, they present Lord Kira's severed head at the altar for Lord Asano, and some of them are ready to go. They're ready to commit seppuku. They figure their job is done, and Oshi says that it would be the easy way to take, and we could just end our lives here in front. but we aren't ashamed of our action. And I feel like that would be the quickest way to show that we aren't going to take responsibility for what we've done. But we have taken responsibility, and we are going to continue to do so. So they go and allow themselves to be incarcerated at the Shogunate's castle and await judgment from the Shogun and the Emperor.
Yeah. Them kind of dealing with the fact for however long it takes. Again, time is not relevant in this movie at all. Well, I mean, it is relevant in the broad strokes, but it comes to, like, the individual scenes, it's like, it's never clear, but that's not important.
Yeah, the only real way you have to tell that time has passed is that occasionally you see outside and the seasons are different.
A scroll will say, 6 months later, this happened, and it's like, right. Oh, okay, so time has progressed. But,
yeah, it's like the Bratz movie, 2 years later.
Yeah, and so it's just like them, you know, dealing with the fact that, well, we just gotta wait for our punishment, and then, you know, then to get the punishment,
I mean, that whole waiting for punishment thing, the shocking part of it is how happy everyone is. Like, everyone is so, everyone of their own is so satisfied with what they've done. And, you know, of course it gets handed down that they are supposed to commit ritual suicide. And Lord Asano's widow sends flowers. There is a part where the master of the servants in the Shogunate's house goes over to deliver the bad news. And his reward for doing so is that the younger members of the Ronin put on a bunch of entertainment for him.
A variety show. They decided to be like, let's celebrate. We did, you know, the honorable thing.
Yeah, it was I will do the best. I plan to do the best performance of the night. No, I'm going to show them with my guitar playing. Like, forget you.
Yeah, it was, you know, one guy plays the flute, one guy sings, one guy dances. And it's like, oh, well, they are clearly content with, not even content, they are, you know, they are happy with their decision and the fact that, yeah, we honored our Lord. So now, you know, we get to honor him by doing an honorable thing of, you know, going through the legal process.
Yep. And the one last thing that happens before the last ritual suicide of all 47 of them, or 46, I believe, one of them, I think, died during the assault of Lord Kira's castle, is the master servant of the castle talks to Oshi, and he says, I brought my nephew here. Because he is growing and he wants to be a samurai, and I thought he could spend some time with you as, you know, to see what real samurai are like. And you see this person, and yes, it's somebody with the shaved head and the dress of a samurai, but it's obviously a woman. Yeah. And Oshi says, you know, how old are you? She's like, 15? Or something like that. And he's like, oh, okay, I don't know. She's slightly amused, slightly annoyed by it. And he's like, I don't know why you're trying to fool me with this, but you guys just need to go home. Okay? Like, this is not going to happen. And it's revealed that this woman, pretending to be a samurai, was engaged and was literally left on her wedding day by one of the Ronin who had infiltrated her family so that he could watch Lord Kira's house. And she is so heartbroken over it. She was, you know, her father, you know, was in love, you know, was in love with this new son-in-law he was about to have, and she herself was in love with it, that she cannot allow him to leave the world without knowing whether or not the love was real. And it's, you know, it's a little touching story. This guy's a bit younger, and Oshi's, he's very hesitant to even give him the chance to talk to her, because he's like, well, he's a young man, and it's really hard for young men to make even the sacrifices that he has. And as of now, he's going to his death. I'm not sure if what you are going to be asking him about and telling him about is going to be enough to, you know, destroy his resolve. But he decides to let the meeting happen. And the young man is, you know, profusely saying, like, oh, I don't even remember you. You know, it was just a trick, you know. And she's being, obviously, you could see her heart being torn out of her body. And then Oshi's like, oh, really? What's that you carry with you all the time? And it's, what was it? I don't
remember.
It was some knickknack. It was something that seems inconsequential, but the whole reason he carried it is because it belonged to her. And even though he talks about how much he never loved her and all that stuff like that, it's obvious that he had feelings and still does. So he finally breaks the facade he was putting for her and says that, I did love you and your father. Tell your father I am his son-in-law. And you need to go on and live your life. You know, you need to be happy and forget me. And the ceremony is set to go. You know, they bring in the robes and the ceremonial daggers, and they start calling names. And it turns out that this woman, this fiance he had, has also committed suicide.
Yeah. Where is it? I think he tells her he'll join her soon.
Yep. It's the last thing he says to her before he leaves. And Oshi is sitting with the shogunate at the end. They're, you know, having a discussion. You know, it was good. None of the Ronin had shown any sort of, you know, hesitation in the ceremony. And they finally call his name, and he goes off. And that's the end of the movie. Yep.
And, it's not necessarily a downer of an ending, but it's kind of a weirdly, like, a bittersweet ending, almost.
Yeah. I mean, I feel it's got the same tone as, like, say, the end of Schindler's List, you know, the way where it's like, you feel a certain nobility in the actions of the people, and even though it's such a sad and horrifying set of situations, like, you can't help but feel this pride for the characters.
Yeah, like they voluntarily chose to follow through with their actions, and they then voluntarily chose to take the proper legal punishment for their actions. So they aren't bad people per se.
Right.
And like the ritual suicide thing is, it's kind of a strange concept, like, outside of Japan, because depending on what part of the world you live in, like, suicide has different connotations to it. like in America and Western Europe, it's kind of seen as a more negative thing.
Right. Anything with a heavily Christian population is going to lean against it. You know, I kept thinking of those old, like, Greek philosophers that were, like, forced to commit suicide. Like, culturally, it was just like, yeah, we're not going to kill you, but you do have to commit suicide. Yeah.
And it made me think of, which one? I think it's Dodeskaden, where there's a guy who wants to kill himself, and he gets tricked, and he doesn't, and he gets in it living. And that, apparently Kurosawa did not like the idea of suicide. It always bothered him. And that was his way of commenting on the cultural acceptance of suicide in Japan.
I see.
But anyway, that just made me think, it's like, kind of Kurosawa, like, his personal views on it. And, you know, so it doesn't show up in his movies really all that often.
Right.
Which is another indication of, like, I don't believe in psychoanalyzing artists by their work, but sometimes it's like, well, some things you can claim, like with Kurosawa, I generally think he was bothered by the acceptance of suicide in Japanese culture to an extent. Like when he attempted suicide, it was a very, very low point in his life. Not like an honorable thing. So it's, I don't know.
I don't feel like there's honor behind that anyways, like even in a situation like this is I we pack honor onto these kind of stories because it's a different time period historically and stuff like that. You don't think about how it's going to impact his family, although you do see Yoshi's family and they're upset when he has to go for the last time. And like it's just like an interesting cultural a phenomenon, like, oh, my husband had to commit ritual suicide, but don't worry, the shogun hand down the order himself. Like, I don't want to
Oh,
know.
maybe it's because we weren't raised in Japan. Maybe that's why it's not as.
I speak for yourself.
Yeah, so I definitely would recommend watching this. I mean, if you listen to this episode, yeah, you're probably you probably would like the movie because this isn't like, Seven Samurai. It's kind of a little more obscure, so you're probably, if you're listening, you're probably the right audience for watching Mizoguchi to begin with. So yeah, I definitely would recommend this 4-hour epic. It's just this, like, it's a, truly a masterpiece.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, did you wanted to talk about 1941 movies
Yeah,
for some reason?
41. All I have, well, 41/42. The dates vary on when Part 2 came out and stuff. But, let's see. So for 41/42, I have only three. Two of them are Disney movies, Bambi and Dumbo. And as a kid, Dumbo just always made me sad. Same with Bambi, but I kind of was more bored with Bambi. And I haven't seen it in probably over 20 years at this point. But Dumbo is this left a real indelible mark, I guess, on me mentally, and just like the image of the poster is like, nope, I'm not gonna watch that.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, and I wanted to force myself to cry, I would watch that baby mind scene. His mother reaching through the bars and having to rock him to sleep.
It's just in the trailer to the new one. I couldn't handle it. I was like, nope. I'm never gonna watch this movie. It's Danny DeVito. It's Tim Burton, and what seems like his wheelhouse. It should, in theory, work, because it has that weird darkness to it. That Tim Burton.
I don't think so. Let's not Tim Burton. Why don't you go do
It's better
something
than Alice
else?
in Wonderland.
I mean, that doesn't say
That's true. I
anything.
mean, it's. It's been, at least closer to what he's good at and interested in.
I guess. I mean, that's not Dumbo isn't goth teenager, and that's what Tim Burton is. He's all about goth
Yeah.
teenager stuff.
And also, Bambi and Dumbo have Sterling Holloway doing voices of supporting characters. Sterling Holloway is famous for the being the voice of Winnie the Pooh. He has that very strange, like, wispy, high-pitched voice. And if you're wondering, was that the actual speaking voice? Yes, it was. That was the voice he was born with. It's very, very bizarre, like, voice that he could either voice like a cute character or like a villain. And like he'd either play like someone's sweetheart, like in sitcoms and stuff, he'd play someone either very sweethearted or very villainous and creepy.
Yeah, he did the voice of Ka in the Jungle Book and the snake character in Robin Hood also.
Oh, yeah, okay. I remember that now. But yeah, I love his voice. It's just, I find it more comforting than creepy.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I didn't realize that the guy who played Piglet in those movies was in other stuff.
He is in.
And then if you watch 12 Angry Men, he's just like there, and it's like, yeah, that's Piglet's voice. That must be the guy who did it.
John, I forgot his name. He was in, I think, 3 Twilight Zone episodes. And every time it's like, oh, Piglet's in this episode.
He's like, oh, deer.
Oh, and 1942 has I Married a Witch with Veronica Lake.
Lake.
I was going to say a different name, but that has someone interviewed on the Rialto Report, which should clarify who I'm thinking of. I Married a Witch. I don't remember much of it besides I really enjoyed it. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, it's kind of a... what is that Hollywood term for those romantic style comedies?
I don't think it's a woman's picture, like that subgenre.
No. Okay, I can't remember. My brain doesn't work. You should talk about your cinematic sin from 1941.
Oh, I've never seen Citizen Kane?
Citizen Crane, the movie about a bird that owns a newspaper.
Yeah, Citizen Kane I have never seen. I've actually never seen a single Orson Welles film.
Oh,
I know him by impressions in Pinky and the Brain, and that's kind of it.
What about the Muppet movie?
I know. I've seen it as a kid, but I have no memory of it. My main Muppet memory was we taped the Fraggle Rock Muppet Christmas TV special, and I watched that a whole lot as a kid, and that's kind of my main Muppets thing.
Well, I don't think he was in those. The only reason I've seen Citizen Kane is because they showed it in my film class that I was in college. And I think I've seen it once after that. But, I mean, like, it blew me away in the film class, obviously. Like, and I can't really put a finger on it, although I've heard plenty of people talk about it. I've read about it and stuff like that. It's just a good movie. It is actually a good movie.
It's not like a situation where it was hasn't aged well.
It's not that it's important because, you know, it did this and it had never been done before. I mean, that is why it's important and stuff like that. And Orson Welles showing, you know, doing a thing that people said shouldn't have been able to be done. And the history of what happened to it at the time.
Like,
you
it's
know.
Good because it's legit.
But it is a good movie.
Like, my main Citizen Kane thing I've seen is the Simpsons episode with Mr. Burns' teddy bear, which I didn't realize was Citizen Kane until I did a rewatch of, I think, season four or five. I think it was the last one Conan wrote on. But anyways, I remember trying to rewatch of that a few years ago and be like, oh, that's Citizen Kane. I never noticed that as a 10-year-old.
Yep. You've been educated.
Yeah. Simpsons is how I learned about Charles Bronson. Because they had a weird thing for Charles Bronson in the 90s.
I killed him. Now I'm going to Emmett's Fix-It Shop to fix
Remember
Emmett.
Remember Bronson, Missouri, where everyone looks like Charles Bronson?
Everyone's Bronson's face? Yeah. So the only 1941 I've seen Maltese Falcon, I've seen Citizen Kane, the Hamilton Woman, which that's Alexander Korda. That's interesting.
I've read the Maltese Falcon a couple times. It's one of my favorite books. I think it's great.
You should watch the movie.
I love the book so much. I'm weary of watching the movie, but I'm sure it's still really good.
I can tell you, Humphrey Bogart's very sweaty in it.
Well, you know, that version was the third version of that. It was a third or fourth. Anyway, it had been adapted as a film like a couple times. One was a comedy with Betty White, no, Davis.
Betty White is not
I
that
get the
old.
names mixed up all the time. Betty Faye Davis.
Betty
And
Davis
apparently
with
it's
the
terrible,
eyeballs.
that version.
Eh.
But
So the movie I actually want to talk about from 1941 is one we watched for Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, called The Devil and Daniel Webster. Alternately titled All That Money Can Buy, but The Devil and Daniel Webster is what it's known as. That's what it's on the Criterion Collection as. And it's about a man in the South who is tempted, not he's not tempted by the devil, so to speak. He just well, he is tempted by the devil, but the devil's a beautiful woman. The devil's also a cocky kind of Irish immigrant-looking dude who's eating pies and dancing around. And then there's this guy named Daniel Webster, who was an actual senator, and he's just a character in this movie who ends up having to defend this farmer who's he has the unfortunate name of let me look at this. It's a weird name. It's like Japheth. Yeah, Japheth.
Oh, you're
And
not joking.
no, I'm not
Okay.
joking. Jabez. 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 And he ends up having to defend his soul against a jury of the dead. Once again, going that there's a Simpsons Halloween episode that
Oh, that's
references
the
this
one where
movie.
Flanders is Satan.
Yes, and he sells his soul for
Oh,
a
okay.
donut.
I didn't know that was a movie. Well, I should have assumed that was a movie reference, just The Simpsons.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really entertaining movie, and if you don't want to listen or you don't want to watch the movie, you can listen to our episode on it. It's one of the earlier ones we did, but I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I
That's
remember
about it.
Sarah and Aaron were not as into it.
They weren't as entertained as I was.
Okay, so the next, wait, the next special episode, I'm not sure what it's gonna be, honestly. So, yeah, we'll figure something out.
I thought we were going to watch a bunch of sex
Some
movies.
Roman pornos, if you want to.
Nope.
Anyway, so yeah, we're not.
What?
We're not
No, I'm
going
just
to talk about those. It'll be something else. I don't know. I think there's a
Yeah, we'll figure it out. What's the next regular episode?
regular. Oh, the police procedural Stray Dog with Will Ashton. Hopefully, Will Ashton will be on that one.
That's cool. I didn't know Kurosawa did a talking animal movie, but I'm excited for
Yeah,
it.
he. I was trying to think of another animal one he did, but I can't think of any.
He also did Food
Oh
Fight.
no. Yeah, so yeah, look out for that. And your friend Dave from The Realist will show up in a little bit. And
he's gonna educate us on some Ozu, which I will
okay.
appreciate.
I can too, because I'm reading the Ozu book.
There you go. What about your stuff? What do you know? I've got that other
Oh,
podcast. What do you do?
some no, Samurai Fight is dead. I miss Samurai Fight. But Jailhouse 701, Japanese cult cinema, gearing up for this series of articles on Hideo Gosha from 1960s to 1990s. But kind of like a writer essay, film essay thing I've ever done, so it'll probably take a little longer to get through and do these. But in between those, I will do a closer review of Burst City, which is basically a 2-hour punk music video. And it's an interesting movie. I don't like it that much per se, but it's kind of sci-fi-ish. It could be on Please Don't Send Me on Outer Space. I might send you the DVD because after watching it, a couple times. Like, I have no need for this anymore. But I'm supposed to be on the Flick 5 Canada again coming up in the next few months. I need to remind Martin, but yeah, we're going to talk about, if I remember correctly, it's David and Lisa and who I picked out. I think that's what it is. So yeah, that will be in a couple months. I was on a bunch of episodes of the Prince Track by Track podcast in late June and early July. I think maybe like three or four. So yeah, listen to that podcast. And Joel was on way, way early on.
Yeah, I was on one episode and not invited back.
Darren, we'll have you back.
No, I don't like music. That's why I wasn't invited
Okay.
back.
He will have you on again. It's fine.
Let me rephrase that. After seeing Under the Cherry Moon, which is an episode of Batman 89 Minute that's coming out pretty soon, I don't want anything to do with Prince for a while.
Okay. Yeah, you'd get his like late era religious conversion era stuff. Okay.
Yeah, I'm busy.
Yeah, that's it. So, see you next time. Hashtag Thuglove.
Hashtag Ronin
Yeah.
forever.
You know.
Hashtag, they didn't really do anything weird in this movie. Oh, man. Hashtag, oh, I'm still recording.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening.
I'm here, top five. Hit them top speed, I drive Mach 5. Rise my 5, now we in the hundreds. We be top gun and Tom Cruise, I'm coming. We cannot lose, I choose if you see me. Smooth like Houdini, the Mussolini, the Kundalini. Shaft, my math, it's actual fast. It's Kenyatta Black, I created half of the cats. Rats and dogs, that's the talk. Boss hog, short death, pass the chalk. Blast that boy like Cash Detroit. Face off, way off like an asteroid. I'm from Brownsville, why would you wanna step to me?